Members, we'll call this meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. We have two agenda items today. The first is a presentation from the Minnesota High Techs Association, and then next we'll briefly hear from the Commissioner of Education and the Department of Education on Governor Dayton's budget recommendations. Let's see, Representative Dietrich moves approval of the minutes dated February 16th. Is there any discussions, additions, or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. So the Minnesota High Tech Association, you're the first ones up on the agenda. Welcome to the committee. Did you bring former Speaker Kelleher with you today or not?
We did not. You'll have to settle with me today.
We'll have to. I will admonish her the next time I see her. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having us. My name is Peter Lindstrom. I'm the Vice President of Public Affairs for the Minnesota High Tech Association. Just wanted to give you a minute on what the MHTA is all about. We're a nonprofit trade association with about 350 corporate members, and we're all about promoting the growth and global competitiveness of Minnesota's technology-based economy. And certainly a big part of that is workforce and what we're talking about today, technology in schools. Things I wanted to mention about that, this is about workforce and jobs, and technology jobs in Minnesota today are really good, high-paying jobs. $77,000 a year is the average wage for a high-tech job. That's 68% higher than the average private sector wage in Minnesota. So if we're talking about jobs, we're talking about the jobs that we want to be creating in the state. These are those jobs. And these are the jobs that are growing the most in the state of Minnesota. Three of the top five jobs in terms of growth are STEM-related jobs. We have medical scientists and veterinary technologists growing at 38%. And we have network systems and data communications analysts growing at 40%, something the chairman knows quite a bit about.
Yes, I like that job stat. Yeah,
absolutely.
That's very good.
You'll have job security for a long time.
Easy there. Oh, it's not the jinx on me, okay? Please continue.
So the members of MHTA are highly invested in what we're talking about today. In fact, we have a new web portal, which we're going to mention a little bit later on, called GetSTEMMN. It's been around for about 2 years. It's sort of a Craigslist-type web portal, a just ask, just offer. So teachers can go online, or anybody at any school can go online and just ask for anything that they want. They can ask for resources. They can ask for materials. They can ask for a field trip. They can ask for a classroom presenter. And businesses can respond to those asks. And likewise, businesses can just offer. They can offer a field trip at their manufacturing plant. They can offer to come into a classroom and talk about the day in the life of an aerospace engineer. They can offer resources, materials. We've just recently had an offer for ball bearings for a science experiment. So things like that. It's a great public-private partnership. Department of Education is our full partner in GetSTEM, along with Microsoft, Honeywell, 3M, Thomson Reuters, and a number of other businesses. So I want to introduce to you a couple of teachers, and if you could come on up. We have Ann Jurwitz from St. Louis Schools and Jen Nelson from Eden Prairie Public Schools. They're going to be talking about how they're using technology in their classrooms. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record so that 100 years from now we know who you are.
I am Jennifer Nelson from Eden Prairie Schools.
And I am Ann Jurwitz from St. Louis Park Public Schools. So, yeah, thank you for inviting us or for us allowing us to be here. And we're going to start with a presentation on basically technology. We both do technology integration and technology in the schools.
We'll be right back.
theater.
Okay. So if you've ever been recently in a high school or had a son or daughter who has recently been in a high school, you may recognize this kind of item that most of them are lugging around with them. And our presentation today is pretty much called Losing the Weight and Unleashing the Potential. So we're going to be looking at specifically how we not only want to look at transformation of education through technology, but also deepening that education through new technology devices, and also preparing our young people for the 21st century in career and college readiness skills. So I'm going to pass that to Jen, and she's going to talk about how things are working in the schools.
So what I'm going to show you are two really significant changes in education that we see coming, that are here in some places, and I think rapidly coming to a classroom near you. And the first is really looking at digital learning. So in replacing the backpack, we're not here looking for a handout. We like to replace the backpack and the content in that with what we can put on a device like an iPad, and show you also how it really levels the playing field for kids in poverty and kids who have disabilities. And so we'll talk about those two pieces. As I just said, you know, this is a time where I know that everyone's coming looking for money, and there really isn't any new money this year. Everyone wants one of these, and so what we're willing to trade, we'll leave you the whole backpack with the 15-year-old textbooks and the incomplete social studies curriculum, and trade for something a little bit more powerful. We're going to show you what that looks like. So kids today are digital. They're growing up digital. Their brains are wired differently than our brains were growing up. And at home, I think they lead very, very media-rich lives. They unplug when they come to school. They have one learning style at home and another when they come to school. What I hope that we see is that our curriculum and our instruction needs to be different. It needs to mirror more of what's going on in our homes. So I'm going to show you three places where that's happening in Eden Prairie. And the first is mathematics. We've done simple things like take our math textbook and put it on an iPad. We're able to get kids more of the curriculum that we've purchased from the publishers by putting it on the iPad, because we're not paying for printing. Kids can choose from that library of resources and get what they need to individualize their learning. When it becomes really powerful is what you see what our teachers are doing.
I'm also going to copy it through point P, point Q, and also through point R. Now that last one's going to be a little bit...
So that's a clip from a video that one of our teachers has made, and we have thousands of these. Kids are able to access those videos from the web, put them on a device such as an iPad, and view them anywhere, anytime, and as many times as they need to see them. We've done a number of different action research studies to see, does it matter that kids have access to media like this? And time again, it does show that video helps. So when I look at this graph, it says kids who are watching more video get better grades on tests. And a more technical analysis showed that kids who watch these videos score a standard deviation above their peers. So here we're really looking at closing the achievement gap and changing the way that our test scores look in our classrooms.
Ms. Nelson?
Yeah.
I apologize for interrupting.
Okay.
But in this committee tends to be just a little bit nerdy, so we like to analyze assumptions that are brought to us, or maybe that's just my way of saying that I'm a nerd. if you could just go back for a second there.
Yep.
Yeah. So you're talking here about, you know, I mean, what's the control factors here? Explain to us, can you tell us a little bit about this study, or is it?
Absolutely. I can start with the first slide.
Sure.
What we did was we took an analysis of one chapter test in chemistry and looked at the number of videos that a kid accessed during that chapter, and the students who scored an A on that chapter test watched between 30 and 40 videos. The kids who got D's or F's looked at less than 20. So the nice part is that I saw that all the kids were accessing videos. What they were doing with them varied by skill level. And that was a very challenging chapter. This is another different test. This is Algebra 2. And we took a look at kids who watched videos and kids who didn't. We didn't require it like we had done in the chemistry course. And the kids who watched the videos, when we analyzed those students against the students who didn't, the students who watched videos scored a standard deviation above the peers who didn't watch the videos.
Ms. Nelson, can you tell me, in this class, Algebra 2, for example, did you need a modified site license from the book publisher? Did they give it to, put it in electronic format for you for free? What was the, do you know the back end processing that to allow that to take place?
You mean in terms of just putting the book on the iPad or creating the videos?
No, just taking the content that was in the textbook and putting it on the iPad. Did you guys do that yourself?
Yeah, we did that ourselves.
Did you? And does your site license allow you to share that with students in other school districts or not?
Not with other school districts, just our district.
How about with the chairman of the Education Finance Committee? Can you share with them? Well, I'm serious.
I think if this wasn't on the record, we could talk.
Okay, all right. We'll talk after
any number
meeting.
Of publishers, well, there's more and more digital curriculum coming out, and any number of publishers, if you just contact Pearson, will let you have exam copies of any and all of those materials. If you're interested in seeing what electronic materials look like, or...
Well, I'm not pirating Representative Dabney. I'll let you proceed with your testimony. If we could try to touch base after the meeting, I'm very interested in seeing the Algebra 2 textbook on an iPad in action. I have one at home, so that'd probably be the easiest way as opposed to me taking your laptop or your iPad. But please continue.
So this chapter was a chemistry chapter, and typically that graph is pretty flat. We have more kids getting C's, D's, and F's than we do getting A's and B's as we look at historical data for this chapter. Our teachers were stunned when they saw the big move from C's, D's, and F's, which are on the right, to A's and B's. And the only difference that we'd done between years was add the video component. And when we talked to the kids afterwards, it made a huge difference for them because they're able to access instruction time and time again at their speed, at their time. Does that satisfy the nerd quotient? Okay, good. So one of the things that was really important was that kind of student data for our teachers, because as they're doing this, it takes a fair amount of work. They get motivated by the success they see, and they start sharing these videos with the world. So if you go to iTunes, you can search EPHS or Eden Prairie High School and access the videos that our teachers are creating for our students, and now they're available to the rest of the world.
So in this case, if I wanted to see the Algebra 2 lessons, we could go out there.
Okay. Yep. We get calls from all around the country about the work we're doing here.
Super. In terms of, do you have teachers in terms of best practices contact you to figure out?
Yep.
Great. Fantastic. Yep.
So as we move away from the video component, we're looking at how do we replace the TI graphing calculator, which is a pretty standard purchase for families in a high school, with something that would fit on here. So here's a 99-cent app that shows you some graphing capabilities of an iPad. And what we really like about it is the interface is easier, and we're able to get this into courses earlier than calculus, because the cost is $1 versus $150. I'd be remiss in mentioning that there's a really great spreadsheet app for the iPad as well, and now we're looking at how using spreadsheets to communicate mathematics can increase kids' ability to communicate as well as their understanding of the content. So I said I'd talk about three areas. We've talked about math. Music theory was something that we used to talk about. And music theory, when you talk about it, is fairly dull. Now today we're looking at music theory using the iPads in choir courses and in a music theory course. So we're able to get it into the hands of more kids. And the action research that we did here was having our choir students sight read. And it was interesting because the choir teacher could hear the difference in the bass singer's parts. Their sight reading ability increased using the iPad. And these were the kids who didn't have piano lessons growing up. They were generally at a sports practice. So as we look at how it's saving us money, in our music theory course, we don't have to purchase instruments for kids anymore. We can download apps, and they can write music for their music theory course with whatever sort of instrument they're interested in. And the last piece that I want to talk about in terms of curriculum is Romeo and Juliet in an English course. So if we take, download the public domain book, and I can give you this one for free, onto here, we're able to highlight, just like we would with the $5 book from Barnes & Noble, we can do some defining of words, and we can search, all within a free app that sits on the iPad. I can go to iTunes U and search for something called Lit2Go, and all of that public domain work that's out of copyright has been read to us. So as a student, I would do something like this.
Romeo and Juliet by William Shakespeare. Act 1. Prologue. Two households both alike in dignity, in fair Verona where we lay our scene, from ancient grudge break to new mutiny.
So Shakespeare comes alive. It begins to be spoken, which is the way Shakespeare should be read. Or, to reach some more kids, I can download an app that has a comic book version of Romeo and Juliet. Another interesting way to look at Shakespeare. So far I haven't spent any money. I've downloaded the book for free, I've downloaded the audio file for free, and I've accessed the ballet.
And the good news is the Xbox 360 has a new version of Romeo and Juliet with the Call of Duty Edition expansion pack. So if you play video games, you get that joke. If you don't, we can move on.
Does it take the swords out and replace them with other things?
No, this guns. It's all guns represented, Dabney. Please continue.
I'm going to spend a few dollars, and I'm going to buy an app that brings a lot of pieces together and makes Romeo and Juliet really come alive for some kids. So we've taken a fairly dry piece of material and really brought a lot to it. And I think once you see Shakespeare acted out, it comes alive for kids. So one of the things I wanted to do was talk about all the apps, but you only gave me 10 minutes. So we're going to flip through some of the apps and just know that there's a lot out there for education. So as we trade our backpack for an iPad, I think there's a lot more we can do with an iPad than I can with a lined notebook in a lot of different subject areas. And so I'm going to switch gears a little bit here. And I've talked about the curriculum component to an iPad. I want to show you how it changes the life for a kid who has trouble speaking.
Eden Prairie High School.
We do a lot of activities to help the general education students learn about disabilities and to be able to interact with students who have various disabilities.
Then I want you to interact with your partners and tell something about yourself.
It sounds simple enough, but for many of these students...
All right, where do you live, Max?
Who else?
Show me?
It's a frustrating experience.
His challenges are making connections with peers and adults, the communication piece for him, the social piece, and functional language.
What do you like to eat?
Spaghetti.
Can you click it for me?
In the past, we've had medical devices that are communication devices. They cost $8,000 and $10,000. And we've had to go through health insurance companies to get them paid for.
That is until Johnson realized many teens are already carrying around a device that can do essentially the same thing.
And then Bonnie came to me and said, hey, I got this app.
It's called ProLoquo to Go.
And I said, a $200 app? And she's like, yeah, but it does so much.
So if I go to About Me...
About Me.
I make custom messages for the students so they can say...
My name is Ryan.
I like skating.
In the winter, I like to go skating on the lake.
Cool, me too.
More than simply communicating needs, the app helps students get to know each other.
Normally, Max will give me a short answer, but if he uses his iPod Touch, he can say, he can select it and say, I went snowmobiling, or I went to Highland, or whatever he did over break. And it's a much better way of communicating for us.
And then to have something that the rest of the kids have, because, you know, you want, as much as he is different, you want him to be like the rest of the kids and have something like a typical teenager to make connections.
Eden Prairie uses apps and portable technology in every corner of the district.
So we use it with preschoolers. We use it with third graders learning math. We use it with high school kids doing science experiments.
And they're finding it works.
So every time we measure it, we see growth, which just gives us more motivation to get it in the hands of more kids. This is the calculator of my high school career. This is the pencil of my parents' education.
Hey, man, go.
Or an icebreaker for two teens to realize they aren't so different after all.
It helps him make connections to his peers. It helps him communicate his needs.
The more that you can communicate and you know what the other person is thinking, you can interact more. Students are more comfortable and it builds that sense of social inclusion.
So we're going to talk about one more piece of the puzzle, which is the equity piece in particular. We're very financially minded as tech integrationists at our school. We're always watching what is the most effective way to be able to spend our money and achieve many of these goals. And so we're looking at things like, you know, broadening our wireless access with guest passwords so that students who have a lot of this stuff can bring it in and we can work in collaboration with them, and then we can really target our resources at the students who have the least amount. So we have a very rich, for example, Admissions Possible program in our high school, which is really targeting students with, you know, high needs, high potential, particularly when it comes to equity and poverty, and working with them around that. Tanya is a young woman who I have in my advanced placement European history class, and she's also in the accelerated English class. And we are already doing a lot of online learning with students in a blended model, and she's really struggled with the ability to do those kinds of things. So she's going to talk a little bit about her struggle, and then we were able to get her an iPad and how that has changed her learning experience.
I'm Tanya, and I go to St. Louis Park High School. I had to go to the library. I had to stay after school, come before school, and I have a car, so it was much harder. I had to do an essay for English, and I didn't have a computer. I didn't have the time because I started working. So what I did was I did my research paper on my phone, and then I emailed it to myself. I came before school to the Library Media Center, and I printed it out. I have to take two buses to go to the library, and I would have to make a reservation, which either it could be from like immediately to an hour almost. Now that I have the iPad, I just have to walk one block, go to McDonald's, sit down, download, do whatever I have to do, and then go back to my house and finish it. iBooks.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I love to read, and I can download free books on my iPad, so now I have a bunch of books and I can read them.
Yeah, so Tanya had downloaded in 1 week 7 books. She had finished one and was reading more. And we talk a lot about how the correlation between literacy and the likelihood of college success being a lot about, you know, traditionally in homes that had a lot of books around them, and now the iPad really unleashes that for her. So we're talking now about 24/7 access, not only in how it unleashes the learning and really unleashes the kick, the internal intrinsic kick for the student, but also offers the opportunity to go much deeper, much richer, and get those career and college readiness skills up to speed, because this is the world that they will be moving into.
I think we can probably just move to questions. We talked a lot about digital learning, and we talked about leveling the playing field. And I think the digital curriculum can do that, and with the iPad specifically.
Now, Ms. Nelson, are there additional testifiers? Because we're done here in 5 minutes here, and I just want to make sure, when we get to those testifiers, then we'll see if we have time for questions.
Okay.
I hope we do, but I want to make sure people who came here to speak with us get that opportunity.
Absolutely.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Ryan Siemens.
Please proceed with your testimony.
Okay, thank you. Well, first off, thank you for inviting Tom and myself. We represent Journey Brothers, who is an audiovisual reseller. My position about a year and a half ago was to support teachers in the use of technology. Tierney Brothers, as well as some of the other technology creators and suppliers, realized that there's some technology out there, but not all of it was being used effectively, efficiently to drive student achievement, to help the teachers be more efficient with lesson development and assessment. So I'm going to go extremely quickly through this, and if you have questions, please please cut me off. I just want you to know, prior to this position, I got to work with Jen. I think maybe they're gone. And her right behind me, thank you. And her position at Eden Prairie is instrumental. I've been able to work with teachers that have worked with her, and the things that she's doing is absolutely amazing. So I just want to kind of give a kudos to her. If you want to look at the screens, feel free. Hopefully I'll describe what I'm trying to get to a little bit better. But one of the main things that we support is smart technology, so the interactive pieces of a lesson, whether it's interacting with content, it's collecting data to make appropriate decisions, those types of things. So I'm just going to jump right through, especially looking at smart boards, different types of interactive displays and technologies. Why? What is the point to having these? Basically, classroom management is one piece. So, you know, you look at what students are doing today. You talk about the video games. You talk about the wow factor. You talk about their everyday tasks and what they're doing. They're always connected in one way or another, and they're always working with content. Now, that content isn't always educational, so using some of this technology can help classroom management, because you're able to focus their current skills in an educational manner to help them learn. It does meet all learning styles. With this, the interactive technologies, you're able to address visual learners, auditory learners, kinesthetic, hands-on learners. If you're looking for people who want to go into the trades, there's different resources for those types of things to be able to interact with. One thing that I like a lot with the smart board and the software is the ability to transform education, or to create resources that are available to students outside of the traditional class day or outside of the brick and mortar classroom. There's a couple of really good examples. One is actually Byron Schools, which is southeast eastern Minnesota, smaller. We're actually working with some of their teachers. A quick example: they are using the smart technologies to record their lessons, make them available the day before, so students actually can view those from home as their homework, and then they come to class ready to discuss what they don't understand. And then the teachers become more coaches as well as teachers. So that's, you know, some of the functionality that's built in there. That is just one piece of the smart product. I'm going to jump ahead here to the things that are most important because of time. Smart response is just the next piece I'm going to talk about, the final piece I'm going to talk about today. This technology allows you to assess students on the fly for formative and summative reasons. So you can put a clicker into every student's hand, and you instantly see the data of what they understand. This came true to me. I remember the first couple of years I taught, you, as a new teacher, you go through and you just kind of follow your peers. You follow the book, and we know that that no longer works anymore, because a lot of what is actually in the curriculum textbooks are not mandated to teach, okay? So they're not really aligning with the standards that we have. What you're able to do now with the clicker system is to assess students on the fly what they know. So I can actually then tomorrow modify my lesson or ask clarifying questions on the fly to help them learn. Okay, so instead of waiting till the end of the unit test, I know, okay, what they're able to do. I'm sorry, I'm speaking really quickly. It's like the Grammys or whatever when the curtains start coming down. But thank you. We will be available. We'll share our contact information, things like that will be available. So if you have any future questions, thank you.
Thank you very much. And my apologies for the limited time frame today. This is a you know, a mistake I made is I have my private sector job. I'm employed in technology, mm-hmm. and I see every day how in the area of technology you are able to get better results at a lower price. It is literally magic. And it's something that candidly in the area of education, you know, the country as a whole, not just Minnesota, but as a nation, we are behind. When you see how other countries are using technology, spending less money and getting better results, whether it's South Korea, China, Finland, even France, they're doing amazing things with it. And I wanted to make sure we had this today. I made the mistake of scheduling this the same time as when the Commissioner of Education is here. But, you know, you hit the nail on the head right up front, and that is that regardless of how we want kids to learn, the next generation has their own perspective on how they're going to do this. And I tell the story about my son who wants to take Chinese, and there's no one at his school who can teach it to him. And he comes home, and he turns on his Xbox 360. He puts in Call of Duty, and he can play against anyone else, anywhere in the world, anytime he wants. And then he pulls out his iPod, and he can pay for any song ever made for $1.29 and carry it with him wherever he goes. And he looks at me and says, tell me again why I can't take Chinese. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's clear that we're just getting, as a nation, we're just getting our socks blowing off us. And it's something that we need to be looking at because we can literally get better results at a lower price. And there's not many things you can do that with in government today. And there's a proven track record in other areas of the public sector economy as well as the private sector that we've done that. So, members, I know you have questions, but the Commissioner of Education is here. This is something that we may take up at a later date, though, and I want to thank all our testifiers for coming in today. And that was, again, not just because I'm personally interested in it, but it's something this committee will be looking at going forward. And thank you very much. All right, the Department of Education, Commissioner Caselius and the crew. Sure. While the Department of Education is coming down, Mr. Crow is going to explain the handouts he's provided regarding the governor's budget that are in today's that are in your folders.
Mr. Chair and members, you have two documents from our office related to the governor's budget. One is a memo that says Governor Dayton's fiscal 12-13 budget proposal. Got some bullet points describing the different information. I just point on the first page that the paragraph on levies, there's a short paragraph, it's the third one. It says levies will increase slightly, they're actually decreasing slightly. And then the other sheet is the first sheet you'll see in a series of spreadsheets as we go through the session that describe in detail the appropriations that you are responsible for keeping track of and changing. And so you can see from left to right, there's forecast, which is the base, by year, and then the governor's recommendations are detailed in the last eight columns. The columns that might be of interest to you say difference governor's rec minus base, and that shows you where the governor's budget makes a change to the base budget that's in place under current law. One formatting note, you might see a change, for example, on line 10. There's a change in negative $1.172 billion in general education. If you look to the left to the program name, if it's not italicized, that means that the change is shift-related and is not a specific initiative. Like on the next line with low-income all-day kindergarten, you see that it's italicized, and there's an accompanying $30 million change relative to base in that change column. And the only two places where there's a mix of shift and initiative is in adult basic education and charter lease aid.
Thank you, Mr. Crow. And could you please state your name for the record so that 100 years from now we will know who you are? Thank you.
Are you returning?
Yeah, you can go ahead and start.
I'm Brenda Caselius, Commissioner of Education.
I'm Tom Melcher, Program Finance Director of the Department of Education.
Jesse Montano, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Education.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you for having the technology folks right before me because it's a nice segue into our programming that we're going to be proposing to the legislature and that the governor unveiled just a few days ago. You know, it is amazing to me how children are turned on to technology. I have my own two little ones, and 9 and 10 years old, 4th and 5th grade, as well as my 21-year-old who grew up with the Nintendo 64 back in the day, Mr. Chair. So he does play Halo. I'm not sure if he plays Call of Duty. Call of Duty.
Call of Duty.
There you go. Okay.
Does he play Halo or Halo 3?
He plays the newest Halo and waits in line for it to come out.
Oh, Halo Reach. Yeah.
Okay, there you go.
So do I. Yeah.
Maybe I can give you his screen name and you two can play together.
He'll probably destroy me, but that's okay. Please proceed with your testimony, Commissioner. Commissioner, somehow this is going to enter the budget negotiations at the end of session. I don't know how, but somehow this will be relevant.
I know, so. I'm going to tuck it away. Well, this morning I had the opportunity to present to the Senate Finance Committee, and I had to follow Health and Human Services. I must say it is quite difficult to follow Health and Human Services given the very difficult decisions the governor had to make regarding that budget. And it's quite humbling to be here today with an investment. But it's also quite amazing that we have a governor who is committed to the nearly 1 million children in this state and recognizes the value of investing in those children and our future economic success in Minnesota. And I do have to say, after traveling yesterday with the governor, as well as the past month in this position, I have found that Minnesotans care incredibly deeply about their children. And I knew this as a teacher and as a principal and as a superintendent, but I really know it now, how deeply Minnesotans care about their children. And one thing the governor said yesterday with these cuts that really resonated with me as a citizen was every dollar that we cut here matters for real people's lives. Every single dollar. And I know that you have to make some really tough decisions over the next several weeks and months. And so I'm before you here in a very serious posture about these investments and feel as though the investments that we are proposing here are ones that are research-based, that we believe will bring us a high yield and a high return for the dollars invested, and will spawn innovation in a way that is just a small amount of money, I believe can have a really big bang for that small investment. So even in the $6.2 billion deficit, especially in the $6.2 billion deficit, we're coming with what I believe are smarter and more responsible ways to invest some dollars. I want to start with early childhood. Many of you are familiar with Art Rolnick's work and the work in Chicago and other areas where there have been investments in early childhood. And how helping parents make quality decisions around the child care that they choose and helping teachers who work in early childhood be the best that they can around preparing students to be ready for kindergarten is essential. And so we are proposing investing $2 million in the early childhood rating system. Furthermore, we know that early learning and kindergarten matters. I believe Mankato has just done a referendum around all-day kindergarten, and they're showing some really good results, and we'll be glad to bring those to the committee when we get to that point. And we also know that several of our districts have made sacrifices in other areas, cutting programs, charging fees to parents in order to provide all-day K. They wouldn't do this if they didn't believe that it mattered. Thirdly, we really believe that if we reward excellence and spawn innovation, similar to what the testifiers were talking about earlier, we believe that can help us close our underperformance and our achievement gaps that have been among children for far too long in this state. So I'm excited to propose two new two new programs. One, the Governor's Award for Educational Excellence. Within this reward, we go around and find the bright spots. We know, and the governor has been in hundreds of schools across the state, and he has seen that there are bright spots, and we want to find those bright spots and reward excellence. We don't only want to recognize excellence, we actually want to incentivize teachers to share that best practice across their hallway, across schools, and across districts, and across this great state. We know that it takes a lot for teachers to be able to plan. It takes time, it takes resources, it takes mileage reimbursement, it takes substitute teachers. And we believe without these incentives that teachers won't be able to share. The second one is innovation, and that was so exciting to hear them talk about the iPads and that new technology and all the other technology that will come out as a result of the iPad technology that will make access much more available for our students, like the student you saw in Eden Prairie who couldn't get to the library. This kind of access is a life changer for children. And it is actually what we are hoping to do with this innovation and technology award for closing achievement gaps in order to target the achievement gap. I don't think it's ever been done before that monies have been set aside specifically for underachievement and students who have been underachieving and finding new strategies to help them. And so we believe that the digital divide between our children and their success matters. And so we've proposed the Governor's Innovation Fund in order to spawn that new innovation. And then just finally, we believe that there are some things we can do without money, like provide better services and support to our schools. And so as an agency, and Ms. Montano will also speak to this, we are going to be reinventing ourselves. We want to provide more leadership and better support to where it matters most, which is teaching and learning and getting closest to the classroom and to our students. And so we commit to do that as well. But if we think we can do this without new revenue, like I said in my speech, that is a proven fallacy. All we have to do is look to the past several years and see and look at our results for all children. We are not getting the results for all children. And we need to be able to provide a uniform system of schools and deliver on the promise our Minnesota Constitution provides for all of our children. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Now, I was told in advance of the meeting that you need to leave at 1:15.
Yes.
So, but I was also told that you'll be back next Tuesday for additional testimony. Is that correct?
Anything for you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thanks, Commissioner. So, members, thank you, Commissioner, for testifying. The Commissioner will be back next week, and we'll have additional testimony and thoughts about the Governor's budget and additional discussions. Thank you again, Commissioner, for stopping in and visiting us today. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, sir.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Program Finance Director at the Department of Education, and I would like to walk through some of the specific line items in the Governor's budget recommendations. You have the change item summary and the change item sheets from the Department of Management and Budget, and then I have a little summary, a one-pager, that I like to use to kind of give you an overview, and I'd like to start with that one-pager, if I could.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members, I've taken the Governor's budget recommendations and divided them into three groups here. The first one at the top of the page, and these are cross-reference to the page numbers in the Department of Management and Budget report. So on page 14, we have the aid payment shift. This is a $1,427,000,000 item in the 12-13 biennium. This would be delaying the restoration of the 90-10 payment system. We would continue with the 70-30 payment approach that we are using during the current fiscal year for two more years, and then the governor is recommending that we pay that back over a 10-year period.
Doctor, just a quick question regarding that. On page 18, of the Department of Education documents, it has the Governor's Excellence in Education Award.
Yes.
And I see in 12 and 13 we have $4.9 million and then $7 million in 2013, which I assume is that you're prorating the 70-30 shift. But then in fiscal years 14 and 15, it shows $7 million apiece. But if we're paying back the shift, shouldn't those numbers be above $7
million? Mr. Chairman, if you're looking on page, on line 18 here, I'm showing a slightly more than $7 million in those out years. We're doing a 70-30 on that money in 12 and 13.
I'm looking at page 18.
Okay, you're looking at page 18.
Oh, you're still on the spreadsheet. Okay, so
I'll need to visit with our management and budget folks about this. The way that I have costed this out on line 18 of the one-page spreadsheet, I'm showing a little bit more than 7140 because we're doing a little bit of payback on the the shift. So it looks like we need to work out the numbers between us and the finance department.
Doctor, I believe that your numbers are right and MMB's numbers are wrong. I'm looking at that right now. I did not realize the numbers were listed differently, but it looks like they just...
We must have missed that as we went through the budget summary, but in fact, in fiscal year 14, we'd be paying really 102% because we're paying back a part of the shift, so it adds up to more than the $7 million.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Please proceed.
So the plan here is 70-30 for the next 2 years, then a 10-year plan to pay back the shift at a rate of 2% a year. So we'd be going to 72% and 74%. And on an overall budget basis, you see a cost of $236 million in the K-12 budget for 14 and 15 to expand that payback. The next section here are budget reductions, and the governor's recommending $27.2 million of reductions in the current biennium. If you look at the third and fourth columns from the right on this one-page spreadsheet that are kind of in a box, you'll see the biennial appropriation change being recommended for 12 and 13 and then for 14 and 15. The governor's recommending a $27.2 million set of reductions in 12 and 13 and about $26 million in reductions in 14 and 15, and then under the reinvestment section, you'll see about a $52 million cost in 12 and 13 for reinvestments, and about $117 million cost in 14 and 15 when you're paying for those on a full biennial basis. So just walking through the budget reductions, and again, you can refer to the MMB document for more detail on each of these. On page 11, we have a governor's recommendation that the Department of Education budget be reduced by 5%, which is about $991,000 each year. I believe this is a recommendation that goes across state government, that the governor's recommending reductions in agencies across the board. The next line is a change in the tax shift methodology. We're currently generating some savings in the budget as a result of requiring school districts to recognize property tax levies early. So 48.6% of the property tax is recognized in May rather than holding that until July. We've had a lot of technical problems implementing the property tax shift because currently, the tax shift is based on a net levy after property tax credits. We get information from the Revenue Department on the property tax credits in December, which is after the statutory deadline for school districts to close their books. And so what's being recommended here is a change in the methodology to look at the gross levy before the credits are calculated, which is information that's available in May before the school districts close their fiscal year, rather than waiting until December to get the data after the credits, and that does create a state savings of $13.6 million for the biennium. So it's a slight additional shift with part of the purpose really being to simplify school district accounting and make it easier for them to close their books and for the state to estimate what those tax shift savings are.
And, Doctor, once again, the spreadsheet and the MMB numbers are not matching up. We're seeing 13.6 is the biennial change, but in the MMB numbers, we're seeing roughly 13.9. Have the assumptions, are there differences between the two?
Mr. Chairman, we've been talking about those differences with MMB and My understanding is that within the next 2 weeks, they are expecting, we'll be repricing all of these things as we do the, come out with the February forecast, and my understanding is that they will be, resolving these differences and coming up with the correct number when we do the bill at the beginning of March. So we're trying to work through that difference. I think part of this has to do with what your assumptions are about the timing of the savings. The change that is being proposed here would take effect for the fiscal 11 early recognition. However, we're assuming that would be implemented after July 1 when the bill becomes effective, so we'd be doing it on the final payment for 11. And it gets kind of into the technical mechanics of when do you put those savings into the budget.
A great many hours of my life have been spent understanding the property tax recognition shift. So just to be clear, so for example, something like the market value homestead credit, right now we base the shift off of a post-credit number, and this would be the property tax value, or the taxes paid before the credit goes into effect.
That's
market value homestead
that's
credit.
Correct. Yeah.
Other credits you may. So if the legislature or the governor were to reach an agreement on eliminating a program that, and I think 6 of its 8 years has been in existence, we haven't even paid out to local units of government, this would have no impact on the property tax recognition shift, because this is, whereas under current law it would.
Yes. Right.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes. Okay, moving to the next line in the governor's recommendation, it's on page 21 of the MMB document, and that would be to eliminate magnet school grants, which are $750,000 per year item. Currently, I think there's about 8 or 10 school districts that do receive those grants, and governor has recommended elimination of those. The next one would be to eliminate explore and plan tests, or at least to eliminate the state funding to reimburse school districts that provide those. School districts could, of course, still choose to provide those tests to students, but the state would not be reimbursing them, and that's a $829,000 a year reduction in state aid. The next item on page 23 of the budget document is to reduce the adult basic education growth factor from 3% to 2%. Currently, adult basic education is able to pretty much keep up with the demand. It has seen significant increases over the last several years, while the general education formula has been held constant. This would continue to provide some increase for adult basic education, but slow the growth to 2% per year. My understanding from talking to our adult basic education people is we might expect some waiting lists in the metropolitan area, but they expect that those would be manageable, where people would still be able to get into the program, but there might be a slight delay in terms of getting them into the program. The next category is QCOMP, and the governor is recommending that no new districts be approved for QCOMP beginning February 1st of this year. So the districts that were approved before February 1st, such as the Anoka-Hennepin School District, would be allowed to continue to move forward, but that the commissioner would not be approving additional QCOMP applications. And there is a budget savings of $4.7 million in the current biennium, about $13 million in the next biennium, and a property tax reduction of about $1.2 million.
Doctor, in fiscal year 11, do we know how much of those funds remain unexpended from the growth factor and currently existing QCOMP?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that with me. I'd be happy to try to look that up. But we have shown that there were some reductions from the anticipated rate of growth. It is a part of the general education program, so each time we do a forecast, we do adjust the funding request down to the latest estimate. So there's not money just sitting out there. It gets adjusted as part of the forecast.
Sure. And did you say that this would not affect Anoka-Hennepin, or was I thinking that in my head?
This would not affect Anoka-Hennepin. They were approved on January 3rd. So the governor's recommendation is that this would take effect for any new applicants that want to come in after basically the budget is released beginning of February.
And do we know at this time, have any other school districts applied since February 1st?
Mr. Chairman, I believe we have two or three school districts that have applied but have not been approved, and at this point the commissioner does not plan to approve them.
Okay, thank you.
The next line is tax shift cost for the reduction in the QCOMP levy, because we, as part of the tax shift, we generate state aid savings when property tax levies grow, because the governor's reducing property taxes slightly here. There's a slight cost on the tax shift because we're not able to shift that and then generate state aid savings. So almost any time you make a change in a levy program, it's going to affect you on the tax shift.
Right. And, Doctor, just to clarify for members of the committee, it's not that levies are being reduced. It's that they, under the lack of expansion for QCOMP, they're not growing. And because we build that in, it's not that we're actually, there's no plan to reduce property taxes. It's simply that the growth is not occurring, therefore there's not property tax shift savings.
Mr. Chairman, you're exactly right. We budgeted for some growth in levies. This is slowing the rate of growth, and therefore, compared to current law budget, we have to show a cost for that. The next recommendation on line 25, or page 25 of the budget document, is to eliminate the grandfather provision from the charter school lease aid formula. Historically, there was a time when the charter school lease aid was up to $1,500 per pupil. In 2003, the legislature reduced that to $1,200 per pupil. However, there were 29 of the 148 charter schools that received lease aid that have continued to benefit from that higher rate back pre-2003. And after 8 years, the governor's recommendation was that we sunset that grandfather provision and have all charter schools be capped at $1,200 per pupil unit. And then the next recommendation on page 26 of the budget document was to eliminate charter school startup aid, which is about $1.5 million for the biennium. Charter schools would continue to be eligible for federal charter school startup aid, so there is some assistance to new charter schools, but also continue to fund the second year for those charter schools that started in fiscal year 11. They get a two-year funding benefit, but for any new charter schools starting in fiscal year 12, they would not be receiving state startup aid. So those are the reductions that are recommended by the governor. They add up to $27 million in the current biennium and about $26 million in the tails. The commissioner went through very quickly the reinvestments that the governor is recommending. The first one is the optional all-day K, and I can say a little bit more about the mechanics for that one. Currently in Minnesota, we have about 44% of all of our students in kindergarten are in a free all-day K program. We have about 15% of our students in a fee-based all-day K program run through the Community Education Fund, and about 41% of the students are in a half-day kindergarten program or an alternate day type of program. And that's pretty consistent between the metropolitan area and greater Minnesota, that we have a number of districts across the state that have chosen to take existing resources and provide all-day K without receiving full funding from the state to do that, because of the priority that they put on an all-day kindergarten program. What the governor's recommendation would do is to provide state funding for all-day kindergarten for those students who are eligible for free or reduced price meals, who are enrolled in a free all-day kindergarten program run in the general fund at their school district. So each school district would have a choice as to whether they want to run kindergarten at all their schools or at some selected schools where they have a high need for those kinds of programs. If the school district elects to provide a free all-day K program to all the kindergartners at that school, then we would take the free and reduced lunch eligible students at that school and provide state funding, which would be 0.388 times the formula allowance, which would be enough to basically fund them at a 1.0 student weight. It's about $1,988 more per student for each student eligible for free and reduced price lunch. Statewide, on the average, about 40% of the kindergartners are eligible for free and reduced price lunch. So bottom line is we'd be covering about 40% of the cost at a typical school. If you had a high concentration of poverty, we'd be funding more than that. If you had a very low concentration of poverty, it would be funding less than that. It's intended to be an incentive to encourage school districts to provide a general fund, non-fee-based all-day K program at their schools, and school districts would have to take some money out of the general fund to cover that. The school district is already doing that, as 44% of the districts are, 44% of the students, then they would have some dollars freed up. They're currently cross-subsidizing from funds that are provided for other kids in order to provide all-day K. If they continue to provide all-day K, which we assume that they would do, they would then have some dollars that are freed up that could be used for other things they may have cut in order to provide all-day K. They could go to a 3- and 4-year-old program. They could do something to lower class sizes. They could use that for other purposes. For those school districts that aren't currently providing all-day K, they'd have to make a budget choice in terms of, given this incentive from the state, where we might for the typical school be paying for 40% of the cost, are they willing to kick in that other 60% with their existing resources to provide that learning opportunity for all of their students?
And, Doctor, the numbers you said up front were currently 41% of kindergartners are currently in half day, 16% are in fee-based programs, and then was it 43% are in?
Mr. Chairman, 15% in fee-based programs and 44% in free all-day K. And that does vary some. In the metro area, it's 19% in fee-based. Rural is 12% in fee-based. Rural, 50% of the kids are in free K programs. But we do have a pretty good spread of these programs across the state currently.
Doctor, in those districts that have a lower concentration of children in the free and reduced lunch program but currently do not offer all-day kindergarten, is it a fair statement to say that it would be of a greater cost to add the all-day kindergarten than a district of the exact opposite situation?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Let's say you had a school district that had 20% of their students in free and reduced lunch. They would have to come up with 80% of those dollars to fund the cost of all-day K, rather than in a school district that had 80% of the students free and reduced lunch, would only have to come up with 20% of those.
And, Doctor, from a policy perspective, if there is a fee-based program already available in these districts to offer all-day kindergarten, why would we require the school districts to do that? Why not just let the students who we're providing additional funding for participate in the existing all-day program, as opposed to forcing school districts to make that choice of sort of all or nothing? What's the policy connotation behind that?
Mr. Chairman and members, I would say, first of all, that this is an optional program. So a school district that does have a fee-based program could continue to do that. Nothing would change. So the governor is not requiring this. In fact, we're not assuming that every school district would opt to change. The budget numbers here are assuming a little over 80%. So we'd go from about 44% to a little over 80%. Because we're assuming some school districts would look at these numbers and say, well, our current fee-based program is working fine. We don't have a problem in terms of getting people to pay, and we have good participation in that current program. They might just keep things the way they are, and that would be perfectly fine. This is an optional program.
Sure. Okay. Yep. And maybe it's not a fair question for you. Maybe it should be for other staff members. I was just wondering if there was a reason that I'm not aware of, because it would seem that if we're going to be offering this program to kids in the free and reduced lunch program, then we would want to make it available to all kids in the free and reduced lunch program and not pass along another sort of an unfunded choice to the school district. But, I mean, I understand you're not the person to offer the flip side of that. Please proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members, I believe the commissioner walk through generally the general policy background drawn for these, but I'll talk a little bit more about the mechanics. The next one is the Governor's Excellence in Education Award, and this would be going to those school districts that have and charter schools that have school sites that are making exceptional student performance as measured by the Minnesota Growth Model. The intent is that this would go to the top 20% of schools, and those are schools that have more than 40% of their students that are achieving high growth. And whether that be high growth where they're in the proficiency area or high growth and they aren't quite proficient yet, but we're looking at that high growth factor. I believe there would be roughly 400 schools out of about 2,000 that would be eligible for this funding. The funding would be on a sliding scale. So if you were just slightly over 40% of your students making high growth, you'd just get a little bit of money. If you had a significantly higher level of growth, you would be getting more money. And the intent here was that up to 50% of the dollars could be used at the site to continue the strategies that have helped them get there and reinforce those, and that at least 50% of the money would be used to provide some dissemination training to either within the building, within other schools in the district, or in neighboring districts to try to capture some of those best practices and try to disseminate those to other schools to try to improve performance across the board.
And Doctor, in the narrative from MMB, it's listed as a non-competitive grant program. What would that mean? Who would decide which individual, which school districts or schools would receive those grants?
Mr. Chairman and members, all of the schools that were that had the achievement over the 40% level, in terms of 40%, would be eligible for a grant. They would have to decide if they wanted to do it. And quite frankly, in some cases, they might say, no, we like what we're doing. We don't want to share. In that case, they wouldn't get a grant. If they essentially, the Department of Education would be reviewing applications for those that to say, yes, we do want to share, that they would basically be receiving an application from the charter school or school district that was describing that program. And as long as they were doing activities that were deemed to be consistent with the spirit of the law and doing that, then their application would be approved. But it wouldn't be a competitive grant where there's only money for X number of schools.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very quickly, and I know we're just really going through numbers, but as I read the language in the on page 18, and I do appreciate the governor's focus on the achievement gap issue, but it seems to me as I read the language that the net could be broader here. You could have a school district that isn't so much challenged with achievement gap issues might well be performing at well above proficiency on the MCA2s, but nonetheless is showing growth with students. Or is that also intended within this framework, both schools?
Mr. Milcher. Mr. Chairman and Representative Mariani, the intent here is that we're looking at the amount of growth as opposed to the absolute level of achievement. And in our kind of Minnesota growth model, we have a low achievement, a medium, low growth, a medium growth, and a high growth. And we look at that both within students that are considered proficient at the start of the year and those that were not proficient at the start of the year. So in this model, we are looking at the students that made high growth, even if they're not proficient yet. And as we look at the types of schools where this occurs in central city schools and suburban schools and rural schools. It's really quite independent of the level at which they start, that you can make high growth in a suburban school district, an inner city school, a rural school. So we're looking at not at how high they are, but at how much they've grown over time, and rewarding that growth. We want the school district to be rewarded for achieving high growth wherever the students are coming in at, and then to have some resources available to share some of those successful strategies with other schools or with other teachers in that school.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Mariani.
Wow, I looked over and saw Representative Graff will change. So, Mr. Chair, then again, this isn't policy committee, but still, I think if I'm hearing this right, I think that this is a really mature marriage of both equity and excellence issues in our state. Clearly, one of the biggest challenges we face in our state has to do with what we call the achievement gap. Those are what I would call equity issues. Mm-hmm. We're also being challenged to consistently drive up the excellence outcome of all our students. And it seems that this proposal is one that acknowledges that there's actually a connection between both of those. And as such, if I understand it correctly, then it really puts potentially into play pretty much any school district out there that is really driving growth, regardless of where students are starting at relative to proficiency.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Milcher, yes, absolutely. And Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murray may already have clarified this for himself, but when you had pointed to the whether the grants were being focused on schools with an achievement gap, my understanding of this is the effect on the achievement gap will be achieved by the sharing of best practices, regardless of the schools from which those practices emanate.
Was there a question to Representative Briner or not?
That was a clarification.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Mulford, do you have any?
Mr. Chairman and members, the next governor's recommendation is the governor's Achievement Gap Innovation Fund, which is found on page 19 of the budget document. This one is a competitive grant program. The idea here would be to provide up to 30 grants, up to $100,000 each, primarily targeted toward innovative use of technology to close the achievement gap, the very kinds of things that we were looking at before our presentation of the governor's budget. How can we use technology to try to look at closing the achievement gap and having ideas come from a variety of schools across the state and finding creative ways to do that. And the final one here is the statewide early learning rating system, providing $2 million for that. The bottom line, there are $52 million of investments that are recommended by the governor in the current biennium, and because the big one here is the all-day K, and that's only being funded 70% of 1 year in the current biennium, you have a relatively large tail there. It goes to $97 million the following year. So overall, the governor is recommending $117 million in new spending in the out years. That's pretty much the mechanics of the governor's recommendations. I think Ms. Montano had some further comments.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe you have in front of you just a one-page handout. And basically what I did, just to give you a little more detail in terms of the agency budget, I took the programs as they are included or outlined in the biennial budget plan by the various areas, and took the amount of budget that each one of these areas had and divided it up by the amount of state and federal dollars that each area receives. And I also divided the FTEs by both state and federal. So you can see that for yourselves. As I previously, I think, testified before this group, but 10 years ago, the agency was funded 60% state dollars, 40% federal, and the opposite is true now. We are 60% federal and 40% state. If you take the total of the general fund funding, approximately 78% of our general fund in our agency operating budget is for staffing cost. The next largest area is 6% for space rent, maintenance and utilities, and then the base rent, maintenance and utilities, and then the other is split in all the other categories. The governor has recommended a reduction of about $9 million per fiscal year. This would result in approximately the reduction of 9 FTEs. As the commissioner pointed out, one of the governor's priorities is to reposition MDE to better support teachers, schools, and districts, provide better leadership and really provide the assistance that our schools, teachers, and districts are requesting. So in looking at a budget reduction.
It's 900,000.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, it was 1 million per year.
We can incorporate that into the committee's budget recommendation for the department.
Can I do this?
She said 9 million, didn't she?
991,000.
Well, if the agency can absorb 9 million, I see no reason why we can't act on that.
I don't think we can. Holy macro, no wonder I saw people fainting over there. Out of the corner of my eye.
The former employees of the Department of Education you're talking about?
I saw them slither under.
No. So it's 900,000, or just short of $1 million.
Short of $1 million, Mr. Chair, per fiscal year. Okay, where was I here? One of the governor's priorities, as the commissioner indicated, was to reposition MDE. So as we looked at that reduction We would look at potentially not filling some vacancies, looking at what vacancies we would need to fill, where we might take positions and combine them with other positions. But as you can see by the breakout in the budgets, that the areas for, like, example, academic excellence, which is our standards and assistance to teachers, the bulk of those dollars are state, and those are areas where, you know, federal dollars are specifically dedicated to programs and grants, and so I think that that's where we would hurt the most.
And you said that this would result in about nine FTEs?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
So if 9 is 5% of a hired number, that would imply that there's 180 FTEs at the Department of Education that are state funded?
There are state funded right now total 155 state funded.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grinley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Montaño, you know, year after year, or biennium after biennium, we seem to be cutting the Department of Education 5%, including again this time, and now we flipped with the 40-60 state and federal amounts of money in the department. How much of that slack is the federal government taking up by increasing funding, or is it stable? And then these are real cuts year after year after year, or is the federal government amount of money, not just the percentage, going up?
Ms. Montaño.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, it's a little bit of both. The department has been very aggressive in seeking grants. Many of these grants are like 3-year grants. Unlike the formula, like the Title I and the special ed, which have been in existence for a while, many of these are competitive grants, so we've been very, very proactive in seeking grants so that we can do some special projects that are aligned with some of our initiatives. And then the reduction in state funding has resulted in reducing staff in those areas where I think assistance to districts such as academic, the standards work in those areas. Those positions are state funded. They're not federally funded, and that's kind of where the agency has taken a big hit. I've been through a number of these reductions, way too many. Don't want to go through another.
Representative Grinley, follow up?
That's it. Thanks.
Representative Woodard.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. To make sure I understand it, you were talking about a reduction of 9 FTEs in 2012, and that would make up for the $1.8 million for over the biennium? Or
over
are you looking at 9 Montaño. Per year?
9 per year. Well, it would, yeah, total of 9 per year.
Per year.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, thank you.
What do we have here? Okay. Any other questions for members of the committee? Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, are we about done? I had a question for Dr. Melcher, and I don't want to interrupt this part of the presentation, so I'd wait till she was done.
Oh, we can multitask and have them both up there, I think so. Thanks, Dr. Melcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, I have a question, and maybe with all of these numbers, it's not that big a deal, but I'm curious and have to ask you this. As of today, the governor's budget proposal is just that. It's a proposal, and I assume under current statute, schools can still apply for QCOMP. So how can a proposal set a unilateral date and end the application process for QCOMP?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, school districts can still apply under current law for QCOMP. I believe that the commissioner has to approve those in order for them to actually get funding, and the applications now would be for next school year. So we will know before the beginning of the next school year whether or not these school districts will be funded.
Representative Anderson. Any other questions for members of the committee? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, I'm looking at the spreadsheet for Advanced Placement International Baccalaureate. Is that a 75-25 split still? Can you help me out there? On what goes to each program? from that total amount?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Erickson, I want to defer to Mr. Crow for that part of it. We didn't make any changes there in the governor's budget, and I think he's got it at the tip of his tongue.
You're deferring to House staff, Doctor? Dr. Crow. Mr. Crow, not a doctor yet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, what was your question about the
My question is, how are the dollars split, thank you, Mr. Chair, between advanced placement and IB? As far as what goes out to school
Representative districts. Erickson, what line are you at on the spreadsheet?
I'm on line 76, under Education Excellence.
Mr. Crow.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I'll have to pull that up.
And you can tell me later. Thank you. Mr. Chair, another question for Dr. Melcher. Dr. Melcher, is our concurrent enrollment increasing, stable, or decreasing?
Dr. Melcher.
Line 77, I see the funding stays the same.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Erickson, the governor did not make any recommendations for changing that. It's currently funded at $2 million a year. It was, I think, funded earlier at $2.5 million. It is a program that is experiencing a significant amount of proration. I believe we're prorating in the 30% range, so we're well below the $150 per pupil that is authorized.
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. One final question, Dr. Melcher. On line 73 for statewide testing, is that assuming the new that's coming down the pike?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Erickson, I'm afraid I'm not really able to speak to the statewide testing. Is just being carried at the base budget level, and I'm not close enough to that to know what the impact would be.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson. Any other questions from members of the committee? Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to either Dr. Melcher or Assistant Commissioner, on the proposal to eliminate plan testing and those tests. I guess first, I'm not clear on the current expenditure for that. I know when my daughter was a sophomore in high school, they took those tests, the plan test. Is it each school district is provided a certain amount for the students that take those tests, or is it money for the department for the scoring and the information that comes to those students? Could you perhaps educate me on that a little bit?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I'm not a real expert on the plan test, but my understanding is that the school districts provide those tests. There's a certain fee, I believe it's American College Testing, that does those, and we're providing state aid to the school districts in a sufficient amount to cover the fee so that can be free for all of the students at the school currently. And so what the governor's recommendation does is it eliminates the state aid to the school district that helps them pay the college of the testing service for the fee, so that would then be up to the school district as to whether they want to continue to provide those tests free of charge for their students or not.
Representative Loon.
Thank you. And just as a follow-up, Mr. Chair, I would imagine it's going to depend from student to student as to whether or not you find those tests are, of assistance to you in preparing for when you take the ACT or SAT or future planning. But would the school districts be able to offer that to students on a fee basis, or would that be in violation of some existing statute?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I'd have to think about that. I think that they could certainly make time available and allow the students to pay a fee for that. I'm not sure of the mechanics, though. I think our fee law just prohibits school districts from charging a fee for instructional activity, so I don't know why they couldn't, but I'd hesitate to make a definitive answer. I don't know if Mr. Strom has a quizzical look on his face. He may have information that might further help me with this one. I think that the parents might be paying the fee and the school might provide a setting for them to do it if they chose.
Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom, do you have any guidance? No.
No, sorry.
All right. And Jennifer Loon, Representative Loon, wins the award for stumping the three experts today. Congratulations.
Did I know?
So maybe if we could have one of the three or all three perhaps find out an answer to that question for Representative Loon, we'll share it with the committee, that would be helpful. Representative Loon?
Well, and just a final question along that kind of slightly odd question, but do all high schools now administer these tests? Every high school in the state, or is it up to the high schools whether they participate right now?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I believe that this is done pretty uniformly statewide currently. I think we probably ought to go back and check with our testing people, though. That's really outside of my area of expertise.
Sure. Mr. Crow has a follow-up piece of information for us.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Loon, on your last question, it looks like 40,000 eighth graders participated in the Explore assessment and 52,000 in the Plan assessment. So there's a pretty significant participation in it. It doesn't really specify the number of schools that were offering it, but it looks like a pretty high number.
Yeah, it's 92,000.
What are we at, about 100,000? We think there's about 60,000 eighth graders, roughly, Mr. Chair. So,
follow-up, Representative Barrett, Senator Bloom.
No, what? Thank you, Chair.
Did
Mr.
I say?
Chair.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, or you meant Mr. Chair, Representative. The second number was 10th graders. So the first number was 8th graders. The second number was 10th graders.
Representative Loon already questioned my manhood by wearing this color shirt today, so you don't need to call me Madam Chair. Okay. So, Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, yeah. Representative Dabney.
Yes,
you're.
Who would say
anything about your? Oh, we're losing control of the committee. All right, Representative Erickson.
Well, I won't put you on any style show soon, Representative Garofalo, but I'll have a word with you about your tie. Anyway, maybe Ms. Montano could answer this question. I noticed in the narrative that there's no proof that Plan or Explore, to follow up on Representative Loon was asking, that there's no research that shows these are successful. Can you tell me what the instrument was that you used to determine that these were not bringing the results that perhaps were intended from the get-go? Because I know that I was part of the initiation of these programs.
To either of the testifiers.
Representative Erickson, Mr. Chair, I would have to go back and look.
Thank you.
I'm not.
Let us know,
I'd
will you please?
That worked with it.
And another question.
Representative Erickson,
thank
before you,
you
ask that question, Mr. Crow has a follow-up from another previous thought. Mr. Crow.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Erickson's question about the APIB appropriation, the 75% of that appropriation is allocated to AB and 25% to IB. AP.
IB.
75% to AP.
Yes.
And 25% to IB.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Erickson, you had another question.
I did. Then with all that commotion, I think I forgot it. So
it's the chair's shirt that's throwing you off.
Yes, it is.
No, here's my question.
Oh, I knew it.
And I don't know if either testifier can answer it. As far as the Accuplacer is concerned, which high schools, I think it's often given to juniors or even to seniors who want to enroll in the concurrent enrollment or maybe PSEO or maybe get ready, get credit. Are we providing any funding for that? Does that come out of a school district general fund or is some other, maybe they pay a fee, I don't know.
To either of the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I am not positive and I would rather give you the
thank
accurate
you.
Information.
That's fine. So those three, the Explore, the Plan, and the Accuplacer, Mr. Chair, I would just like to know how they're funded in.
Doctor, will you be getting the answer for that question?
And what the results were.
Mr. Chairman, I believe Ms. Montana will go back and talk to our testing people and their office folks.
Other questions for members of the committee? Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Either one of you, I know there's some grants and so forth that are available in the budget, but in the basic budget where you've got dedicated funding and so forth that's available to schools, one of the things that I've talked about a number of times is the funding gap between schools that are on the low end of receiving state dollars and those on the high end. Is this budget going to close that funding gap, make it wider, or maintain it where it is? Thank you.
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative,
Fabian, I would say that the changes in this budget are relatively modest and probably will not have a significant impact on the overall distribution of funding between high versus versus low revenue school districts. I would say that probably those school districts that have the highest concentrations of poverty do receive somewhat more money on the average than school districts that don't. And given the fact that the governor's recommendation on early on kindergarten would provide more dollars based on poverty, that there might be some slight increase for high poverty schools versus low poverty schools in this. But it's such a small percentage in relation to the overall size of the budget. You know, we're talking $30 million out of $1.6 billion, that I don't think it would have any real measurable impact there. There is one other thing that the governor is working on that may have a bigger impact in that regard, and that is that the governor is intending to assemble a working group on school finance issues more broadly. He had an interest in school finance and in the kind of increase in the gap in revenue among school districts, and there simply wasn't time as we were working on governor's budget proposals to really flesh that out and develop a proposal. But he does plan to convene a working group to be working between now and the end of March in terms of identifying further kinds of ideas, recommendations that may speak to that. But at this time, in the budget itself, I would say, in direct answer to your question, that there would be a minimal impact in terms of changing the distribution.
One of the changes the governor proposes is with regards to the shift payback and stretching it out over 10 years at a rate of 2 percentage points each year. However, under current law, are you familiar with the automatic payback provisions that currently exist in law?
Yes.
So, Doctor, how would that coincide with those provisions? Because right now, if we were in a situation where next November, for example, mm-hmm. the forecast comes back very good and the cash flow account is full and the budget reserve account is full, I believe the general education shift is automatically paid back. Would this statutory language override those, or would the schools be paid back more aggressively?
Mr. Chairman, the way that those two will work together is that in the event that the state budget situation improves more rapidly, that the language in Minnesota Statute 16A.152 would take precedence. So what the governor's recommendation would be to guarantee, even if the state budget doesn't allow us to implement that other statute, that it would be paid back over 10 years. But certainly if the situation improved, the language will be written so that the automatic payback would kick in.
And Doctor, I just want to make sure I understand that absent any legislative action, the language in 16A will, if there was no action by the legislature, that payback automatically takes place.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Thank you. Other questions from members of the committee? I've got a couple of follow-up questions here, and then we'll be done for the day. First of all, Doctor, are you familiar with the current provisions with regards to TRA? Last year we passed legislation that increased the employer contribution rates, which in this case would be school boards or...
Yes, as I understand it, there's a rate increase for fiscal 12, and then there's a kind of a gradual increase after that, yes.
And, Doctor, are there any provisions in the governor's budget that account for these costs that the legislature and the previous governor passed on to school districts?
Mr. Chairman, there's nothing that specifically would fund those costs. I suppose for the 44% of school districts that are currently providing all-day kindergarten, the additional money for all-day kindergarten would be used for all-day kindergarten, but that might help indirectly resolve part of that issue.
Okay. And the final question is, with regards to the governor's budget exempting the 44% of school districts in the all-day kindergarten provision, is there any language in the governor's budget to provide for increased payment to teachers for higher salaries or higher benefit costs?
Mr. Chairman, I would say no, unless it depends on the exact uses that are put to the high growth fund, the governor's awards for excellence in education. I haven't seen the language yet in terms of the specific uses that could be made to the 50% that can be used to maintain high performance at those schools, whether any of that might be for compensation or not. I haven't had a conversation on that language yet.
Given that answer from the doctor, Ms. Montano, does that mean that the governor endorses the proposal for a freeze of school district employees' compensation costs? I'm just kidding. You don't have to answer that question.
I don't think I would comment on that one.
Yeah, I'm just teasing you. So, well, members, thank you very much. And again, I just want to point out to members, obviously, the governor's budget is based off of an approximation of $4.1 billion of additional revenue. And while the February forecast will improve and will probably improve substantially, I think it is beyond the expectations of this member and other members of this committee that we're going to see $4.1 billion in improvement. So we should keep in context that the assumptions that are before us today are with a very large revenue increase, and to once again reiterate the difficult choices that the governor, as well as members of this committee and members of the legislature, will have to make. So, is there any additional comments or questions from members? Seeing none, this committee is adjourned. Thank you.